Good morning. We are back, Bostopia News with Evan George, to do a very classic Bostopia News episode, and that is digging back into the past lives of our Boston City Councilors. After covering the BPDA hearing last week, it has restored my vigor and passion for this quirky group of 13 councilors, their dramas, their pasts, their conflicts. And if you haven't yet, on my Patreon page, there's a nice little collection for you. And you can listen to the bios that I have done of the past Boston City Councilors, many of whom are still on the council itself. And the only person who is a veteran who I have not done yet is Liz Braden. Comically, I've never gotten around to doing that episode. However, I am not going to start with her. We're going to continue to delay. And I am going to go in numerical order. So we've already done an episode on Flynn, already done one on Gigi, or at least I interviewed her. So there was enough there if you want to get more inside of her mind. And now we are left with District 3 new Boston City Councilor John Fitzgerald, who also just so happens to be my district representative. And before I go any further, as many of you are probably aware, I supported his challenger isn't the right word because they were both running for a first time, but his head-to-head matchup of Joel Richards, who I still regard as a dear personal friend. So you can take everything I'm about to say with whatever grain of salt you need. Now, I have met John once before. It was at a neighborhood event, basically. We spoke for a good amount of time. And at that point, it was pretty obvious that he was going to definitely make it out of the preliminary stage and probably was the odds-on favorite, because that was many of the jokes that I led with to have our conversation. And parts of that I'll keep to myself, what we discussed. But my initial impression was I was not too impressed with him. However, since I've seen him on the council and I've heard him speak more as I've just tried to learn more about him, he is an intelligent human being, which is a low bar for an elected official, but he does pass it. There is a mind there and it does seem to work, though I disagree with many, many, many of his stances. Now, how politically adept he'll be, who's to say? And reading just directly from his Boston.gov page, the oldest of four children, John grew up in a tight-knit Boston family where serving others was an important family value. His mother, Patricia, worked as a nurse, while his father, Kevin, served for over 28 years as a state representative. And we're definitely going to get into Kevin because he is crucial. The number one thing I heard on the doors was how much everyone loved his father. And I want to remind everyone of what Frank Baker said in his farewell address. He was quoting someone else, but I'm going to just attribute it to him. That you win your first election because of who your parents are. And I've always said the number one way of getting elected is to really just have a famous father or uncle come from a big political family in a local area with a famous last name. And that is absolutely what Fitzgerald has. And it is funny because in a previous episode, we discussed Johnny Fitz, who was an iconic Boston mayor. I don't believe there's any relation, however. Now, also a funny thing about our John Fitzgerald is that he capitalizes the G in Fitzgerald, capital F and a capital G, and he does that as an homage to his paternal grandfather. So I would like to learn a little bit more about who he is, but if you ever see it in print, that is why. Now, John attended Boston Public Schools and, of course, attended Boston Latin. He joined the Mayor's Youth Council, and following high school, attended Northeastern, receiving a bachelor's in communication and then a master's in business administration. And during his time in Northeastern, he minored in Spanish and studied of all in, I'm just going to play with the pronunciation, Sevilla, Spain. And during that time, traveled throughout Europe. And when he received his MBA, also from Northeastern, it focused on international business and he spent time in Mexico and throughout China. My guess is Northeastern has a satellite campus in probably definitely China. Wouldn't be surprised if it was Mexico as well. Now, he grew up in the Mission Hill JP area. That's where his father was a representative. And he moved 10 years ago to the Adams Village area where he currently lives. And his wife's name is Megan, who was a public school teacher. And as referenced again in his little piece, they have three beautiful children, Callahan, Mac, and Teresa, with the two oldest attending Boston Public Schools. And John coaches his son's t-ball, flag football, and street hockey team. And the child's ages, at least as reported last year during the race, 6, 4, and 2. So while that must be a handful. And the only little nugget that I also know about him, and this came from a reliable but will be an anonymous source, is that John used to be a big party boy, used to drink a lot, I believe weighed a lot more than he currently does. However, it seems like he turned his life around, definitely for the better, and has an incredible relationship with his wife. Great guy, you know, got all that out of his system. So take that for what it's worth. Now, and John is in his early 40s, was 41, at least as of, again, the race last year. So we'll say 41, 42. And at least according to his LinkedIn, his first job after getting his MBA was with the Boston Redevelopment Authority, which we will all know as the Boston Development and Planning Agency, when they did a rebranding. And he held a number of positions, went from project manager, senior project manager, director of Olympic operations and special programs. And this is maybe one of his first big connections with politics, again, besides growing up with a very famous father and probably in and out of those worlds. Was he oversaw the process for Boston's Olympic bid to try to get the 2024 Summer Games in Boston. And he was Marty Walsh's official Olympic liaison for this process. And it looks like part of his job would be he would have to, you know, hold all these public meetings, try to sell the public on the idea of Boston hosting the Olympics, which many people were against, and for the right reasons. That would have been absolutely horrible and horrific. You'd never, ever, ever want the Olympics coming to your city. It is nothing more than a drain of resources. But it does give some wealthy individuals the opportunity to make a lot of money. Now, fortunately, that went under, and it seemed like as soon as it did, his next position with the, I think just around this time, the name started to change. I'm just going to keep calling it the BPDA. You all know what I'm talking about. He became the deputy director of Imagine Boston 2030. And this was another initiative under the Walsh administration, really. But again, like, you know, this agency is quasi-public anyway. And it was his job to really just kind of facilitate the creation of that entire document. Now, the PDF is 472 pages. And what this is supposed to be is almost a massive imagining with all of these, I mean, this took years and years to build. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people were said to have like weighed in on it. I think it cites 15,000 voices contributed to this plan. But ultimately, is just this odd document that has absolutely zero power. And in the best case scenario, you could say is like a blueprint or a vision board of what Mayor Marty Walsh wanted Boston to look like, but it is not used in any way to guide development in Boston. It is essentially a meaningless document that really was just created and exists to make people feel as if they were part of this process. They had some input over development in Boston. But as everyone knows, there is no overarching plan that we're actually following. And how development in the city works is a developer and a group of investors will look at areas and say, hey, where can we make a lot of money? Hey, what if we bought that plot of land and we turned it into lab space, office space, luxury condos? Great idea. That's going to be the best use of our dollar to increase it and to make the most amount of profit possible. Let's put in a bid. And then the BPDA, as I covered last week, they're just in charge of growing the tax base. And they say, oh, will this bring in wealthy people? It will. Fantastic. Let's do it. And it's piece by piece, block by block, development by development. There is no overarching vision for this city. And so this, I mean, he basically spent like a year of his life on what is essentially a meaningless document, I hate to say, but is a great distraction and does give the appearance of people having input though again, it is not used in any real way. Regardless, from there, it looks like he may have stepped out of the BPDA for a little bit, where he became the Director of Business, Capital, and Finance. This is under the Office of Economic Development, again, still at this time, under Marty Walsh. He was there for about 2 years and 4 months, it says. And then around early 2019, goes back to the BPDA to become the Deputy Director of Real Estate Operations. And this is where I believe this was his position while he was running for office. So really, his entire professional life has been within the BPDA. And that, of course, explains a lot to why he was voting no against Mayor Wu trying to transition the planning agency within that organization to one that is under city control. He likes the BPDA. He likes how isolated it is from the democratic process, which makes sense because he grew up in it. And now, normally, this is when I would pivot to the campaign. However, we now need to talk about his father, Kevin Fitzgerald. And as I mentioned before, the number one thing that I heard while knocking doors in Dorchester for Joel was that people were supporting John because of how much they loved Kevin, his father. And I'm not going to do as deep of a deep dive into Kevin. However, he was elected in 1975 at the age of 24. And he mostly represented the Mission Hill area. And I am mostly reading from his obituary, which was published in the Globe on October 2nd, 2007. So I believe he died, we'll call it October 1st, 2007, or maybe just at the end of September, of cancer. Just reading bits and pieces of that now. Political promise blossomed early for Mr. Fitzgerald, yet at the time he was hesitant to accept it. Although he was elected student council president at Mission Church High School in 1967, he was more interested in sports than politics. When he was picked by lottery to serve as the state's student governor for a day, the lanky 6'3" senior was daunted by the prospect of delivering an inaugural address and attending committee hearings, if even for a few hours. So I guess we kind of did a playful get to be the governor of the day thing, and Kevin Fitzgerald was selected. Also, references height, 6'3". John is also a pretty tall guy, from what I remember. Later on, colleagues said Mr. Fitzgerald had built his political career on advocating for the poor and dispossessed, an outgrowth of growing up in a close-knit Irish Catholic family that believed strongly in education and helping others. He was a city youth worker in South Boston at the outset of the desegregation, trying in his works to keep the peace on the streets. And it was also referenced in this that he was somebody that people were talking about becoming Speaker of the House or perhaps the Mayor of Boston. And I believe he did manage to become the Majority Whip. However, reading from a New York Times article, December 22nd, 1991, titled "Lawmaker Resigns as Party Whip in a Massachusetts Ethics Inquiry." First paragraph. Under prodding from an ethics panel, a longtime member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives resigned from the post of Majority Whip late Friday night because he had accepted a $200,000 inheritance from a troubled woman who had turned to him for official help. The resignation by the whip, Kevin Fitzgerald, a 41-year-old Democrat from Boston, came only hours after the House Committee on Ethics agreed to recommend to the full House that he be stripped of his leadership position. That sanction was the most severe available to the committee, short of a recommendation that Mr. Fitzgerald, who had served in the House for 17 years, be expelled. Mr. Fitzgerald's resignation was reluctant, announced in a defiant speech on the House floor. In relinquishing my leadership post, he said, "I do not mean to imply that I agree with the committee's decision, but having a fancy title is no more a part of what I am than money is." And this investigation apparently lasted 10 years. And it originated, as this piece goes on to say, in July of 1981. And how the story goes is a woman named Mary Guzlin, I apologize, I'm mispronouncing her last name, we'll call her Mary, sought Fitzgerald's help when she was being evicted from a rent-subsidized apartment, back when we used to have rent control. However, the effort to remain in her apartment failed. She ended up living on the streets, and then was unfortunately struck by a taxi and killed when she was 68 years old, and this was back in 1985. And the problem was that in a will that she wrote, she left $400,000 to Fitzgerald and to another woman. And what it appeared is that this will was written very close to when this other woman, Miss McDermott, became the guardian over Mary. And in fact, I think it was just 8 days after this woman became the legal guardian, she successfully petitioned a court to have, you know, I don't know what they call a power of attorney, power of privilege, I forget. But to have the power over someone's will, and then 8 days later, a will was written, which basically gave $200,000 to Kevin Fitzgerald and the other $200,000 to this woman. So it looks shady, to say the least. And I'm not going to really comment any further on it. I'm not going to spend too much time investigating it. But regardless, as written in his obituary, going back to the Globe article, a more devastating fall came in 1991 when Mr. Fitzgerald resigned as majority whip after the House Committee on Ethics voted to relieve him of the powerful post. Those actions followed a ruling by the State Ethics Commission that he had violated state conflict of interest laws by accepting a bequest of about $200,000 from a troubled woman. He denied any impropriety occurred and continued to be reelected. So he did win election for probably about another five cycles after this, when he then became the sergeant at arms, which is a position I think he took up in 2002. And I think they kind of just, you know, managed the ceremonies that they do over at the State House. And I'm not bringing this up to disparage his name in any way, but does seem to be a very important part of his father, that being Kevin Fitzgerald's political history. And I believe John Fitzgerald was 25 years old at the time of his father's passing. And of course, losing a parent, really at any age, I'm sure is horrible. In your early to mid-20s, I'm also sure that's very difficult. And fundraising for cancer research has also been, understandably, a big part of John's life. So reading back again from his Boston.gov bio. In addition to the years of public service working at City Hall, John has always remained committed to supporting his community and other worthy causes. He has served as the president of the Tobin Community Center for the last 20 years, and since 2008, so the year after his father's passing, has been one of the lead organizers of Team FITS, an organization established following his father's death from cancer, where riders raise money competing in the annual Pan Mass Challenge. Since its inception, Team FITS has raised over $1 million for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I think that Pan Challenge is like a cycling thing where you go across Massachusetts. Don't necessarily quote me on that. But fitness overall does seem to be a little bit a part of John's life. Reading from a Dorchester Reporter article titled Dots John Fitzgerald Steps into the Ring to Fight Cancer Cure, May 5th, 2016. John Fitzgerald hasn't stepped into a boxing ring since he was 12 years old at the McCon Post. God, I'm going to get killed in this episode with the pronunciations. But he'll give it a go on May 19th when he tries to knock out cancer and his opponent at the Haymakers for Hope 6th Annual Rock and Rubble Charity event at House of Blues in Boston. Ever since, we have been doing things to raise money for cancer awareness and a cure, explained John Fitzgerald. Usually, I do the Pan Mass Challenge, but I am getting married this summer, so I had to do something to take the place of that. After talking to my boss, Sarah Meyerson, about it, she told me her husband founded Haymakers for Hope. When she told me that, I had to do it. So he did a charity boxing event. And also in 2016, he ran the Boston Marathon, where, according to the Boston Marathon results, he had an official time of 5 hours and 5 minutes and 4 seconds, coming in overall at 24,756th place. I have never run a marathon, so he has a better time than I do. Though judging by both his time and his build, not necessarily a runner's body. We'll just leave it at that. But now that brings us to 2023, where at Frank's announcement that he would no longer be seeking another term as a District 3 counselor, I am absolutely positive he got a knock on the door pretty early and probably even before that announcement. Hey, you've been working for city government for well over a decade. You have a famous last name. Everyone knows you. What do you think? And with an open seat, who doesn't want to shoot their shot? And in terms of the race itself, I've already covered it in the past. It was a massive field. I think there was maybe eight all competing to make it out of the prelim where it goes to the final two. In my quick recap, I would say early on, Matt Patton was the odds-on favorite. However, John quickly picked up steam. We're going to talk about his fundraising in a little bit because he got into some trouble for that. And from his famous last name and having well more money than anyone else in the race. And my friend Joel Richards just knocking five times the amount of doors as all of his opponents. Those two then advanced to the general, where after the redistricting map was thrown out, which would have removed areas of Adams Village, which now that I voice that out loud, kind of would have been interesting if John Fitzgerald lived in one of the neighborhoods which was going to be relocated to District 4. That's a fun what if. But regardless, those areas being in and having the highest voting percentages in the city, primarily white, conservative, older voters, overwhelmingly went for him. Reading again from the Dorchester Reporter in their synopsis on November 7th, on Tuesday, his opponent, Joel Richards, won several precincts in Wards 16 and 15, but by the margins that could not compete with the lopsided numbers posted by Fitzgerald in Neponset and Adams Village. Fitzgerald, for example, won his home precinct, being 16-9, which, okay, to the best of my recollection, 16-9 still would have been in District 3, even if it didn't get thrown out. However, a lot of the surrounding communities absolutely would have. But regardless, Fitzgerald won his home precinct at the Adams Street Library by a tally of 495-70. There's just simply not enough voters in Boston who are going to be able to make up for that because, as we all know, people do not vote. And as the Dorchester Reporter cites, longtime city planner who currently works at the BPUDA, Fitzgerald, 41, benefited from close ties to organized labor, developers, other donors to amass the largest election war chest in the council field. He was buoyed by endorsements from former Mayor Marty Walsh, Baker, who publicly backed Fitzgerald ahead of the preliminary election in September. And he also got the endorsement, I believe, from the Boston Herald. But now let's talk about that money, because he, similar to his father, got into a little bit of trouble for it. Now, from Boston Globe, Danny McDonald, October 19th, 2023, title, "This Boston City Council candidate has more than $100,000 in his coffers. His campaign says he didn't raise a single cent of it." Reading from the second paragraph, state ethics law is clear. Non-elected public employees cannot receive, directly or indirectly, any contribution or anything of value for any political purpose. However, they may run for office as long as a committee is organized to raise money on their behalf. Basically meaning that from Massachusetts law, if you are a public employee, and this can be something as small as like a teacher, you are not allowed to directly fundraise. You are not allowed to ask people for money. And now it gets, to me, a little trickier when you are in higher levels of public employment. Like, for example, if you are a deputy director of the agency, which determines what developers get funded or not, what projects get approved or not, you might be able to swing your weight a little around and asking for some donations. But also, you really don't even have to. Developers are going to know, hey, that's the person we need to grease their palms. If they win, we have an ally in office. If they lose and they maintain their position, they're probably going to give us a little thumbs up on our application because they know that we have their back. No, nothing in state law prevents that. That level of corruption is not just allowed, but it is encouraged. And I have always said that I do not like these state laws about how public employees can run for office, because I always view them as being stifling, as only existing to protect incumbency, to make it so people who work in city government in some capacity, that could be anything from a teacher to a clerk to something in City Hall, or in this case, the planning department. But yeah, people who work in public fields, people who work for city government, guess what? They probably have an interest in city politics and probably maybe envision themselves running someday. And so to hamper that, to handcuff them under the guise of fighting corruption, you say you can't fundraise. However, as I outlined before, because you're able to take so much money from so many different people, from so many different corporations, that you can just have that money washed if you just have a little bit of common sense, you know, not to get caught on a hot mic directly asking for it. So our corruption is just hidden. It doesn't make it not exist. And these barriers are just to really punish people. Like, I think this happened with Henry Santana also during the race, because like, oh no, you picked up the phone in this room and stay large, you gotta exit the room before you make the call. To make it, again, make it seem like it's anti-corruption when in fact it's just to protect incumbency. That's a long way of saying I give John a pass on this. Though it has to be stated that a deputy director of the major planning, well, the only planning department of Boston, was able to fundraise the largest war chest without picking up a phone. That, again, to me is corruption, but that is not necessarily John's fault. So I give him a pass on this. But it did come up during the campaign, so I get to talk about it here. And similar to what I did with the other city councilors, I'm going to leave you with his maiden speech. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about it before I do. But I also want you to hear from a GBH interview he did, because when I said in the beginning that he has a mind, that he is most certainly sharper than Frank Baker, and I think how he answers this question in the interview gives you a sense of that. And then we'll talk a little bit about his politics and what he has done on the council thus far. So take it away. I believe this is Jim from GBH News interviewing John Fitzgerald during the campaign.
So you're running to replace Frank Baker, who I think of as one of the more staunchly conservative voices on the council. You're running with his backing, backing of other people, including former mayor Marty Walsh. Yeah. How do you describe yourself ideologically?
Well, honestly, I prefer to stay away from all ideological forms. But when I was out knocking doors, a lot of people would say, well, are you like Frank? You know, do you align with Frank?
That's depending, what I was trying to ask.
Yeah, and depending on where you are in the neighborhood, some wanted to hear yes, some wanted to hear no. And my response was always, look, nobody's Frank, right? Frank is his own person. Going into that, I have a very different, we share some set of values, right? I think that I'm going to go in there and be my own person. I have a little bit different characteristics, a little bit different temperament than Councilor Baker probably had. But there are some core things there that sure will stick, whether you want to call them conservative or progressive. I plan on bringing common sense.
Can you give me...
Now, before I continue, while that is politically a nonsensical answer, that is still a good answer, because most people do not have a coherent political ideology. That definitely goes for politicians themselves, but also voters. So, you know, people who say, like, I'm not left, I'm not right, I'm not progressive, I'm not conservative, I'm there for common sense. Like, that statement makes sense in the minds of a lot of people, though if you listen to this program, you know how truly idiotic that is. However, I give points for how he answered that question, especially the uniqueness of saying there's only Frank, and him only knocking him by talking about his temperate and his rhetoric, something that, again, Frank got into a lot of hot water when he tried to bring the Troubles and brought up the Protestant Liz Breeden trying to rip apart the Catholic diocese of Dorchester. Anyway, it continues a little bit.
Give me a couple examples. You mentioned there are core things that are going to stick, whether it is something you think of as conservative, progressive, something else. Give me one or two.
Sure. I support our public safety officials, our police, our fire, right? EMTs. I think we should be doing more to support them. And because they're going to be needed in the future. And so we may have to make sure that they're trained appropriately, recruited appropriately. And they're the best in the nation now, but there's no reason we can't get better.
Okay.
And I think I said that was John. It wasn't. That was Adam. My mistake. And so what does he say? The first thing that comes out of his mouth, what does him and Frank share? What was that first word? Police. Which is not at all a shock. Because John, as I said during the campaign, as I still strongly believe now, will vote identically to how Frank Baker votes, and that has only been proven in the last few months. And in terms of his politics, there was another thing during the campaign that got a little bit of a headline, and that was a coalition called Save the City. And if you remember this drama, it was in July of last year. It was originally going to be a fundraiser for Ed Flynn and also simultaneously a party for his father, Ray Flynn, celebrating his 84th birthday. However, it then became a political event for a not yet disclosed organization, PAC, called Save the City, which in an email was labeled as a three-year mission to save the city of Boston from the negative impacts of the ultra-progressive policies that dominate the current city council and current administration at Boston City Hall. Now, in an email that was sent to the Dorchester Reporter ahead of this, then blew up, mostly because you cannot have coordination between the candidates and PACs, like political action committees. They have to be completely separate. So doing a joint fundraiser for what is supposed to be a completely separate PAC that just supports candidates but doesn't have any involvement with them is highly illegal. Again, to the point that we even have election laws, that's like one of the things that it's an IQ test. Like, you're an idiot if you get caught, though it's something that a lot of organizations do, is they coordinate together. And this is just kind of an open way of doing what is always behind the scenes. But regardless, it blew up in everyone's face. And on the list to attend was, of course, all of the white conservatives, the outgoing councilor Frank Baker, Aaron Murphy, Michael Flaherty, and yes, John Fitzgerald. He is very much part of that team. And in the first big test of this, what did we see with the vote for the BPDA, for removing the planning element away from that organization, absorbing the personnel, absorbing the property within the city of Boston, rather than having it being its own separate entity, which is how it's been existing for decades, was the three no votes. Ed Flynn, Aaron Murphy, and John Fitzgerald. Those three vote and coordinate as a block, very similar to when they had the four white conservatives, being Michael Flaherty, Frank Baker, Aaron Murphy, and Ed Flynn. Michael Flaherty and Frank Baker are no longer there. Fitzgerald took Baker's spot on that coalition. And where we're really going to see that coalition try to have some impact is, of course, on the upcoming budget. Though, as everyone knows who can count, Michelle Wu has the votes. She has eight basically locked up on the Boston City Council. And since you only need seven, she can even afford to lose one if necessary. And that assumes that Julia and Tanya can try to operate together. But that process is still a few months away. And really the only other thing he's done on the council, and I made the comment that he definitely is sitting at the big kids table, we'll call it, not necessarily waiting or being muted by being a freshman city councilor, very much with jumping up into the fight. And you'll hear in his maiden speech what really like the first priority or the first resolution is, and that has to do with trauma response. But the only other thing that he has done really of note that has made some level of press is proposing that handicap spots be accessible to pregnant women. And not just pregnant women, but new mothers. And this should be a little bit ringing in your ears when I told you the ages of his children. Again, while he was running, he has three children, all under the age of six. So I'm sure he very much has had the experience of driving around with his wife, with his children, or hearing stories of his wife having to take the three kids, seeing all these empty handicap spots and thinking, why can't I park there? And so, like, this is definitely a piece of legislation that is just directly about his own experience, which is a very conservative thing if you've been following this program for any time. And it's comical because in that GBH interview that he did with Adam, when asked, what will be your first, piece of legislation you file, he begins with, well, this is really selfish, but I want all of Dorchester youth sports to be under, like, one website to make it easier for me to plan my kids' different events. So again, something that we generally see from conservative minds is just about their own experience and what they own witness, and that is what they then think are priorities. Now, I am not going to weigh in on, do I think pregnant women or new mothers to have access to handicapped parking spaces, outside of my own logistical curiosity of, you know, well, someone who's pregnant has to like file for a special placard. Do you just get the ticket waived by then proving you're pregnant? What does that process look like? And I am sure there are many members of the disability community that would be very much against this. However, apparently it's not necessarily a novel idea in that in Illinois, it allows disability cards to be used during the third trimester for a period of 90 days. But anyway, That's a good example of the pieces of legislation that he is filing and where his mind and focus is. And I think that's really my only thoughts on John at this time. I definitely think I'm going to disagree with many of the big votes that he does. He seems to be a smarter, more personable version of Frank Baker. But as I say many times, it's how you vote that matters, not the pretty speeches or your own pretzel twisting of explanations as to why. How you vote, that's really what this all comes down to. But having said that, I hope to have somewhat of a positive relationship with John. So I hope me bringing up stuff about his father doesn't immediately blacklist me, since he is my counselor, and I already have experiences with at-large counselors who will not answer very simple constituent questions because I may have said negative things about them, or more accurately, negative things about how they voted in the past. So it would be nice for my district representative to answer an email should I ever feel the need. And with that, I'm going to again play you out with his maiden speech. And I probably won't keep in when the other counselors weigh in, but it is notable the first two people to speak after him is both Ed Flynn and Aaron Murphy. And they both talk about how proud proud Kevin Fitzgerald, John's father, would have been of him or is of him. I just think that's of note. And another thing, of course, of note, is if you want to go back and listen to the bios of our current Boston City councilors, best way to do that, patreon.com/bostopiannews. I have a whole collection for you there. And of course, if you like this level of reporting, you like people focusing on local news, local politics, you want to give some money and support local journalism, best way to do that is to become a Patreon member of mine, where you can buy me a cup of coffee a month, or a beer a month, or even a lunch per month as a way of saying thank you to helping support and grow this program. And with that, take care, and as always, have a great rest of your day, and here is John's maiden speech.
Thank you. The chair recognizes Councillor Fitzgerald. Councillor, you now have the floor.
Thank you very much, Council President, and thank you to also my family and friends who stuck around. I paid them to stay, so they're actually getting overtime right now, but I'm thankful that they stayed for as long as they have. And I appreciate you taking me out of line for my main speech. When I first began campaigning for this past year, I spoke of one major theme, that of keeping families in Boston, and that when the infrastructure for a city is built around families and their needs, it is to the benefit of all residents of the city. That infrastructure involves housing, schools, jobs, amongst others. But all of these cannot exist without one overlying principle, that we feel safe in these spaces. To feel comfortable and to free up space in our brain from any perceived fear so that we can concentrate on the work to do in front of us. Whether that be a spelling bee, putting a cover sheet on your TPS report, or simply making your kids lunch at your own home. Essentially, to keep families in Boston, an individual's mental health around these matters must be prioritized, and safety is our top priority. However, we also know that it is not within our capacity to deter all the issues that burden the realm of public safety. Though I'd like to take this moment to thank our police, fire, EMS, school teachers, moms, and many others that help to maintain the safety of those spaces on a daily basis. It's no easy feat. But instances will still arise where a community, a neighborhood, a home will be negatively impacted due to a breach in safety. And on the morning of January 1st of this year, as I made my way in town for our swearing-in ceremony, I learned of just such an event. At Meeting House Hill, just hours earlier, a young man's life was claimed by gunfire, the first murder in Boston of 2024, and in a neighborhood that also held the title of having the last murder of 2023. In the following days, I had conversations with the folks that lived on High Street, some were here earlier today, and they asked me if they could be shown some love, some support, because even with violent crimes down across the city, a trend we will work to continue, there are still some neighborhoods that are not seeing that trend. And as they spoke about the incident, I thought about the profound traumatic outcomes that these folks have to live with going forward. Obviously for the families of the victim, but also for the secondary and tertiary victims and their mental health. I heard from the family that lives on the street that now has to think twice every time they walk out of their home. from the individual that found the victim, still shaken from witnessing such an unfortunate sight, from the children who cannot make sense of the incident and the possibility that this could be normalized for them, and from the community as a whole, who felt they did not know where to turn to work through their feelings. I asked our district attorney, Kevin Hayden, to send some folks from his office to attend the community civic meeting that month, and their presence and their kind and informative words began the process of healing. However, it was clear that these folks still needed so much more. They lamented the fact that they had not received any communication from the city or our neighborhood trauma response team, that there was no one there to flyer the surrounding neighborhood with information about resources, and that there's typically little to no follow-up with the community after such an event. Now, there are some great organizations that do their best to provide these services, such as the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute and the Bowdoin Street Health Center. But we, as a city, need to do better in providing our constituents with these support systems and not rely solely on nonprofits and other entities in which we cannot have our own oversight and accountability. My hope is that with this hearing, we could shed light on the work of the services we are offering and lend more support to the efforts of our hardworking city workers and esteemed members of the Boston Public Health Commission that tackle these issues on a daily basis. Traumatic experiences such as the one I described, along with many others such as domestic abuse, bullying, and the like, carries long-lasting implications. We have all heard the phrase, hurt people hurt people. And so it is imperative we take it upon ourselves as a city to be there to stop that cycle. And if violent crime is truly trending down, then it should only mean more resources can be concentrated to the fewer instances of when it does occur, so that no community ever feels like they are left with nowhere to turn. And in this specific community of District 3, that has recently been grappling with murder, shootings, teen suicide, and other traumatic experiences, it is all the more important to provide them with the overwhelming resources to not only help them heal, to move on, and to overcome, but more importantly, to demonstrate that overlying principle of public safety, to show that community, that individual, and that family we strive to keep in Boston, that they are loved. Thank you.